to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. Before we get started, I want to mention that KABU is in the last week of our spring membership drive. KABU is commercial-free, volunteer-powered radio made possible by people like you. Not only that, KABU has trained thousands of people how to make radio, all for free, thanks to the support we receive from our members. So help us reach our $56,000 fundraising goal. Your donation will be matched dollar for dollar up to $12,000, thanks to the generous support of a group of anonymous donors. Just go to kboo.fm/give or text kboo to 44321. Thanks for supporting community-powered radio. As pressure increases for us to drastically reduce carbon emissions, one attention-grabbing option being promoted is renewable hydrogen. But is hydrogen really the answer to our energy needs, or is its promotion largely based on false promises? Today we talk with Eric DePlace, fellow with the Ohio River Valley Institute, about the pros and cons of relying on hydrogen for our energy future, and peel back the hype to reveal the limitations of this brave new world of energy. Eric, welcome back to Locus Focus.
Thanks, Barbara. It's always good to be on your show.
Well, we've been talking a lot about fossil fuel for the last number of years, and you've been part of the movement that's really helped to derail the fossil fuel train, both figuratively and literally here in the Northwest. But it seems like there's a new interesting challenge on the horizon, and that's the promotion of hydrogen as the next clean energy. So I want to talk with you today about the pros and the cons of hydrogen, and maybe start with why are so many of the fossil fuel companies so interested in promoting themselves as hydrogen manufacturers and distributors now?
That's a great question. I think a great place to start. I think as many listeners may know, many people in the Northwest know, the Pacific Northwest has fought off a whole series of proposals to transport and export huge quantities of fossil fuels, coal, oil, gas, petrochemicals, you name it. Most of that stuff is now in the rearview mirror, thank goodness. And now what we're confronted with, both in the Pacific Northwest and in other regions, is this whole new hype cycle around sort of next generation energy projects. And right at the center of that hype cycle is hydrogen and a companion set of projects called carbon capture, utilization, and sequestration, or CCUS. And we are in kind of the Wild West of that right now, where, you know, we've got all kinds of craziness going on. Not all of it is a bad idea, just probably most of it is a bad idea. And so maybe over the next, 55 minutes or so, we'll be able to talk about kind of what the contours are, where it might make sense and where it definitely doesn't make sense. But to answer your question a little more directly, the reason why there's a fair bit of interest in hydrogen right now by the fossil fuel industry is because hydrogen is potentially a way to prolong their business model, especially for the gas industry, just in the same way that we have seen proposals to convert gas into liquefied natural gas, LNG for export, or methanol, petrochemical for export. You can convert gas into hydrogen and use that as, it's a terrible idea, but, and then use that as an energy product. So the fossil fuel companies like this because they think it could be a reprieve. And if you care about the climate, it's not a reprieve we want to give them.
Well, let's talk first about why is it such a bad idea to convert natural, so-called natural gas. A lot of people now are trying to use the term frack gas instead. Why is it such a bad idea to use that gas to produce hydrogen?
Well, there are a few different reasons why it's a bad idea. For one thing, if you are taking fracked gas, methane gas, we'll use the more technical term today. We'll use methane because on a molecular basis, that's really what they're doing is they're taking the methane and then using a steam reforming process to basically separate out hydrogen molecules, and that becomes a hydrogen that's used for energy. That's a bad jam because what you're basically doing is taking a climate warming fossil fuel, natural gas or fracked gas, methane, and converting that into another form of energy. But you're getting basically all the same emissions profile that you would from gas in the first place, and then you're sort of hiding it by saying, well, look, the hydrogen over here, that product is relatively clean, but of course it comes from a dirty product in the first place. So you don't get out of the sort of carbon emissions problem that we have with gas in the first place. Plus you have all the problems of fracking at the source. You have problems with methane leaking all along the route and so forth. And then the problem gets worse because what actually happens if you start producing large quantities of hydrogen from methane is that instead of doing the things we know work to decarbonize our energy system, we're doing something that doesn't really work. So we're actually displacing, slowing down, and delaying a clean energy transition. And so it's really, really dangerous to think about using gas to produce hydrogen for any large set of the economy at all. It shouldn't be done, really. Now, they think they have a workaround to that called CCUS. We'll talk about that, I'm sure. The workaround is not as advertised, and that's a big part of the problem, too.
Well, I've been watching Northwest Natural's campaign to promote itself as the bridge fuel to the future of renewable energy. And I think, well, we haven't talked about it, but other people on the show have talked about the whole scam about renewable natural gas and how that is really not what they're claiming. I wonder how you compare this push to use hydrogen as the next bridge fuel, using natural gas to produce it, how that compares with the whole scam around renewable natural gas.
Yeah, I think it's, you know, it's broadly similar in the sense that, you know, with renewable natural gas, and I've written about this when I was at Siteline Institute, I've written about it in some other places too. Renewable natural gas is just mostly a bad idea. There are niche applications where it actually makes sense. Like, you know, if you have existing emissions from a landfill, or if you're on a dairy farm and there are some little applications where it probably makes sense, but it's not a large scale solution. And there's a big risk that the hype around it then actually, again, delays or distracts from legitimate decarbonization efforts. And so, you know, hydrogen really kind of fits that profile. And Northwest Natural and other utilities, other players in the gas industry, I mean, you've got to hand it to them. They are very good at marketing, and they are very good, because they study this stuff, of figuring out what people kind of want to hear and are ready to believe about their product, and then crafting strategies, messages, and policies that allow them to basically continue business as usual. That is a very polluting, very, very bad deal for the climate and for our health. But then kind of dressing it up, like, or they'll take what is a small truth. Renewable natural gas can be a good thing in a few applications. Hydrogen can be a good thing in a few applications, and then blowing it way out of proportion. And so what we really have to do is to make sure they stay in their lane, and that these become, you know, selectively used niche applications where we don't have other good solutions, but not start using them for the whole suite of craziness that they want us to believe that the products are good for.
Well, what do you think is the best way to counter the kind of propaganda they're putting out? Because it is just, there's an onslaught of advertising, promoting natural gas in its new forms, among them hydrogen, as the answer to the future. And the other part of it is that they say electrification isn't really possible on the scale that would completely get us off of fossil fuel. And they also, one of the big pitches that Northwest Natural has is that we need to have gas as an alternative to electric when the power's out, which we had that experience last winter here in Portland. So how do we counter that?
Yeah, I think, you know, we want to, from my perspective, sort of start with first principles. And the first principles are basically twofold. It's we need to do two things simultaneously. We need to clean up the electricity grid, and we need to electrify everything that we possibly can electrify. And if we do those two things simultaneously, there are a whole range of studies in the Pacific Northwest and other places that show that we can get the vast majority of what we need to do to decarbonize our system. We can get it done with those two. So electrify everything and clean up the electricity grid at the same time. The Northwest is actually making great progress on both of those fronts, particularly on cleaning up the grid. We need to move a little faster on electrifying everything. The risk then becomes that we take these little grains of truth from the gas industry and we misinterpret them, or we believe what the gas industry has to say about them. Now, is it true that at the very, very, very end of decarbonization, you might need a percentage or two of gas on the system to provide stability for the grid? Yeah, maybe. There's some evidence for that. It's not completely made up. It's just mostly made up, and it's totally blown out of proportion. And so what we want to do is make sure that over the next, the real risk for us is that we don't decarbonize fast enough. It's not, as the gas industry wants us to believe, that we're going to decarbonize too fast. That's not a risk I'm particularly worried about, nor should anybody else be worried about. We want to make sure that, again, you know, whether it's gas-fired power or gas for fill in the blank, hydrogen, renewable natural gas, whatever, you know, that it's a teeny tiny little bit that is selectively deployed to just the right use. And again, not something where we're looking to maintain the existing level of infrastructure, and certainly not build new infrastructure to support it. That's not a good idea.
When I started learning more about hydrogen, I learned that there's three different colors of hydrogen. And so I wanted to distinguish between them. What we've been talking about mainly now is, I guess, the gray and the blue. And then there's the green. Let's talk about the difference between gray hydrogen and blue hydrogen to begin with.
Yeah, so we'll start the 101 course on hydrogen, and I'll just let you know that there are also there's also pink hydrogen. There's now a purple hydrogen. There's some other stuff, turquoise hydrogen. We won't go into all that today because it's not really relevant. But so think about it like this. So we'll start with gray hydrogen. Gray hydrogen right now is 95% of all the hydrogen that's produced in this country is gray hydrogen, and that means basically that you use a fossil fuel, usually oil or gas, to for a steam reforming process, usually with methane, and what's happening is you're separating out the hydrogen molecules and turning that into a pure hydrogen system. It's done at oil refineries quite often as a an ancillary product, sometimes used to actually power stuff at the refinery itself. It's a very carbon intensive process. It uses a lot of energy. It produces a lot of carbon. It's well understood in the industry. Not a big secret about this. It's been going on for a long time. That's gray hydrogen. So the only thing that's different about blue hydrogen, and this is where the hype cycle starts. The hype cycle starts with doing the exact same dirty process to create hydrogen, and then basically capturing all the carbon dioxide that's emitted from that process and storing it somehow or using it somehow. And that sort of magic bullet solution then makes the hydrogen go from gray to blue. Now, as we're going to talk about later on, the carbon capture strategies don't actually work, and they're super expensive. So blue hydrogen is basically gray hydrogen with a very thin layer of blue lipstick on it. And then green hydrogen is a different beast. So with green hydrogen, you're actually using a different process entirely. You're using electricity through a form of electrolysis to extract hydrogen. With that, you actually can get, if you're using clean electricity, then you do have something that looks like a low carbon or a zero carbon fuel. And that green hydrogen probably is the kind of hydrogen where we're gonna need some of it for a fully decarbonized economy. So that's the area where there is a little bit of promise. But again, there's risks with that too, because it's a very energy intensive process. It uses up a lot of electricity that could be used for other purposes. And so if we're producing green hydrogen, we want to make just the right amount, and then we want to use it in just the right places. That is not wide scale deployment, but very, constrained, narrow applications of the green hydrogen. But that's the kind of the overview of those three colors, gray, blue, and green.
Is it cheaper to make hydrogen from methane than it is to make it from water? I'm wondering why is the rationale for gray hydrogen?
Well, the rationale for gray hydrogen right now is that hydrogen can be deployed for certain applications, high heat applications in particular. And so it's only really used in select industrial applications now. It's not like, right, so gray hydrogen's been made for 30, 40 years, I don't know how long. And the industry can use it in certain industrial refining applications, and they've been doing that for a long time. Except for the latest hype cycle, there's no real push to like make a lot more gray hydrogen. That's not really the risk. The risk area is that people are going to basically say, well, we're going to make blue hydrogen, but what they're really doing is just making gray hydrogen, and they're trying to use that hydrogen for any number of things where it shouldn't be used.
Well, I was just wondering, if green hydrogen costs more to make, is there a reason why they're not pushing green hydrogen as opposed to blue hydrogen?
Yeah, so right now, as a general matter, green hydrogen is more expensive to make than blue or gray hydrogen. That's not likely to be the case for very much longer. Depending on which analysts you read, it looks like we're 10 to 15 years away from green hydrogen being at cost parity or even cheaper than even blue hydrogen. In as much as green hydrogen is going to be cheaper in a few years, and that's really the kind of hydrogen we want to focus on anyway, all the more reason why the right strategy with hydrogen now is do nothing, is not build up a bunch of infrastructure, is just wait for green hydrogen to get a little bit cheaper, then we'll do that and we'll apply it again selectively in its narrow applications. But right now, it is more expensive than gray or blue hydrogen. And so that's one of the reasons why the industry is really moving fast, because they want to lock this stuff in to their advantage now before they get competed on price by clean electricity. Same thing that's happening with the gas industry everywhere and the coal industry everywhere. They're losing the race, the economic race. And so they're trying to lock in more infrastructure, more stuff now before they get priced out of the market, basically.
Well, you're listening to Locus Focus on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Oregon, Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM, KMUN and KCBB in Astoria, Oregon, KCEI in Taos, New Mexico, Radio Free Moscow in Idaho, and Radio Tacoma. And today we're talking with Eric DePlace, who's a fellow with the Ohio River Valley Institute, about the pros and cons of relying on hydrogen for our energy future. And I want to remind you that now is a good time to become a member of KBOO during the last week of our spring membership drive. KBOO programming focuses on local communities, artists, activists, and people like you. Join now and help us meet our $56,000 goal. Your donation will be matched dollar for dollar up to $12,000 thanks to the generous support of a group of anonymous donors. Just go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Or you can mail a check to KBOO FM, 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, 97214. Thanks for supporting community-powered radio. Speaking of coal country, since you've been doing a lot of work in coal country in the last year or so, I've learned that what is going to be the defunct coal-powered plant in Centralia, that they want to convert that to a hydrogen facility. And I just wonder what your thoughts are on that whole thing, because there's a lot of hype right now about making Centralia, Washington, the hydrogen center of the Northwest, if not the world.
Well, I'll be honest, I haven't looked carefully at that proposal at all, so I want to be careful about commenting on it too much. I do think, I will say a couple of words about Centralia, though. So it is great news for the Northwest and for the climate that the coal plant at Centralia is being phased out. That's certainly good news. Also really positive economic news from the Centralia region. There's lots of evidence that the transition planning and the funding that went into the transition plan away from there has actually yielded substantial benefits. So as you mentioned, I do a lot of work these days in West Virginia and Pennsylvania and some other parts of Appalachia. And we're really looking at Centralia as a model for how to transition away from coal. So Centralia used to have a small coal mine, and it has a coal power plant that's being phased out. What's happened is, as they phased that stuff out and invested money in the community for transition planning, the county has actually outperformed the state economically. Washington's doing well economically, but the county has actually outperformed the state. It's got better jobs, better business growth, better income growth, and so lots of reasons to think that coal transition can work well. So I kind of look at Centralia as, in some ways, a working model for how to move away from fossil fuels and do it well. Certainly something that Pennsylvania and West Virginia could learn from. With respect to the hydrogen proposal there, again, I haven't looked at it carefully, but I think that the right way to approach this stuff is with caution and skepticism. It could be that they've got enough clean electricity there to produce some amount of green hydrogen. But it's setting up some careful guardrails and making sure that we're not building out infrastructure that is essentially supporting the gas industry for the long term. That would be a very bad deal and would take Centralia right back into the same fossil fuel dependent loop it was on for many decades.
Well, I've been hearing about how Centralia is a role model for transitioning away from coal, but when I was reading some articles in the local newspaper in Lewis County, the Chronicle, a lot of the elected officials, with the notable exception of one county commissioner, are really gung-ho about this hydrogen project. And they're talking about how the tax base in Lewis County crashed with the demise of the Alta coal-fired plant, and that this is an opportunity to rebuild the tax base. I don't know if you know anything about that, and it could be a whole other aside, but it seems like, whether that's true or not, there are people who are making the point that Centralia needed that coal-fired plant in order to have any kind of economic viability. And so this hydrogen plan is a way to replace the economic viability that's being lost by the loss of coal there.
Yeah, what's unfortunate is that those claims are not borne out by the economic facts on the ground. And the Ohio River Valley Institute, where I am now a research fellow, has written pretty extensively about Centralia, so I would encourage folks to look into that. But what happens, and I think this is a good sort of illustration of the way that we think about the energy economy and the economy in general in the wrong way, is we tend to look for the big ribbon cutting ceremony. We tend to look for the big factory or the smokestack and say, well, if that big project is here, then things must be good. And if that project goes away, then things are bad. And that's not really an accurate reflection of how the economy works. And so what's happened is that small-scale investments in a place like Centralia that look like energy efficiency, where you're putting people to work, weatherizing homes, you're also reducing energy bills, you're creating more money circulating in the local economy, all that stuff yields more benefit very often than the big smokestack that's behind a chain link fence somewhere on the edge of town. And so that whole model of economic development in Appalachia is a good example of this. It doesn't work. And now you get a few exceptions to that rule where you do get a corporate headquarters that lands someplace and then boom, there are a lot of jobs there. But for the most part, that's not the real story of how economic growth happens. And so I think there's a real risk in Centralia that the sort of elected officials there are saying, well, we just need another big project here. And if we have another big project, everything's going to be fine. You know, not that a big project is necessarily a bad idea, but economic facts on the ground don't bear it out. What may matter is improving the housing stock, investing in energy efficiency, putting contractors to work, doing all that distributed stuff that's saving people money, creating local jobs, and creating that positive, you know, circulation of benefits in the local economy.
Well, one of the other red flags about the Centralia project is that Richard DeBolt, who was a big player in Northwest Innovation Works methanol refinery proposal in Kalama, and he was then a state representative. So now he's no longer an elected official, but he's head of this Economic Development Commission in Lewis County. And he's a big promoter of that. So I wonder what your thoughts are when you see somebody who's had a history dripping with methanol coming in and promoting hydrogen.
Well, it certainly makes me nervous to see the same cast of characters. You know, the methanol project that we've spent, and I know you spent many, many hours talking about on this show, you know, it's methanol is fracked gas dressed up in a different form. I mean, it was going to pipe huge quantities of Canadian fracked gas down, convert it into a petrochemical, and ship it to China. You know, so the risk is that hydrogen becomes another version of that. You're going to pipe down huge amounts of natural gas from Canada, turn it into something else, in this case, hydrogen, and do stuff with it. So, you know, I'm always skeptical when I see the same folks involved in a new project. But, you know, again, without knowing the specific details, I don't want to cast too many aspersions yet. It wouldn't be just of me.
Well, we'll do that in a few months. It's a long ways from happening. I mean, that's another thing we can get into is you mentioned that the timeline for green hydrogen is 10 to 15 years out. And people are looking for an instant gratification. And hydrogen promoters seem to be promoting hydrogen as that instant gratification. But even with this Centralia plan, it seems like they're not even going to decide on it for a couple of years. What does that say to you about maybe some of the scam aspects of hydrogen?
I think any project like that has got a bunch of yellow flags up and maybe some red flags. You know, and to be clear, I'm saying that green hydrogen on average will be cheaper in 10 to 15 years. It may be that there are some instances in which it works now or sooner than 10 to 15 years. You know, and again, without actually looking at the economics and the configuration, you know, I can't say definitively Centralia is a bad project or a bad idea. You know, but certainly there are lots and lots of reasons to be worried about something like that.
Well, speaking of scam artists and methanol, I came across V. Gottlieb a few months ago, who was one of the leaders in trying to get methanol established in Kalama with an organization called Northwest Innovation Works. And I was doing this Google search for him and discovered that Northwest Innovation Works had dissolved, actually. And V. Gottlieb was now at a new place in Texas called Clean Hydrogen Works. And interestingly, the logo looks almost the same, except there's an H2 as opposed to whatever they use for methanol. So I just wanted to run by, you know, some of the things I saw on their website and what kind of flags that raised. It's very clearly that it's blue hydrogen because they talk about carbon capture and sequestration is like the big deal, which we'll get into more in a few minutes. So that's how they call it, clean hydrogen. But what really struck me was how they're going to ship this hydrogen around the world. And they say on their website that the hydrogen will be shipped in tankers across the ocean in the form of ammonia. So I just wondered what you think of that.
Well, that sentence makes no sense whatsoever. So that's a cautionary flag right there. There are in the sort of wild west of, you know, of crazy new energy ideas, there are a couple with fracked gas, with methane. One is to create hydrogen, probably blue hydrogen if they can get away with it, and the other is to create ammonia. But those are different. Ammonia is now produced in large industrial quantities, mostly as a precursor to fertilizers. There's some belief that it can be turned into a maritime fuel. Denmark and some other places are making some investments in ammonia powered ships. And then there's a whole other bunch of folks who want to use ammonia as an energy storage vehicle. But ammonia and hydrogen are not the same thing. And I don't know why he would conflate those two, because they both come from gas. That's true. And that should be the alarm bell for anybody right there, is that this is really just gas.
I was wondering if what they were proposing was that they were going to ship it as ammonia, and then when it reaches its destination, then the nitrogen is separated from the hydrogen, and then you'll have hydrogen, which that doesn't make a lot of sense to me. But
I mean, it's certainly possible that you could do that. I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if they had something like that in mind. But, you know, what the thing to remember is when you're doing something like that, when you're taking gas, converting it to ammonia, shipping it, reconverting it into hydrogen or whatever else they're going to convert it into, I mean, you're using a ton of energy and potentially a ton of emissions at every step along the way. So not something you would do if you have any other option from a decarbonization standpoint. Now, if you're the gas industry, that might be a fine idea. But if you want to save the climate, you really want to minimize, you know, and this is why you have people like Elon Musk and others who are saying, like, why would you use hydrogen as an energy storage vehicle that is not as a fuel but as a way to store energy? Same with ammonia. The energy inputs dwarf what you get back out of it. So not a good idea as a general matter.
One of the few things I probably agree with Elon Musk about.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, exactly.
I'm surprised to hear you quoting him. But
yeah, right. Right.
Well, let's talk a little bit about carbon sequestration. It's an interesting, controversial issue, and I actually interviewed somebody a couple years ago who believed that it worked, that there were working examples that were feasible of carbon sequestration. But then I've also heard people like you talk about how it's really not that feasible. So I wonder, are there examples of it where it is working and that could be models for using it in the future?
I mean, there are small-scale examples of it working okay. I mean, and it's not like, I want to be like super clear, like carbon capture and storage, if we could figure it out, would be awesome. That would be really, really cool. And we probably do need some of it to fully decarbonize. It's just that here's the problem. Most of the models we have of it don't work, and some of them really don't work. And almost all of them are very expensive. And so, you know, should we invest some money in R&D to figure that stuff out? Absolutely. Should we rely on it? No way. You know, we're going to have to do a bunch of things and try a bunch of strategies that may not pan out in order to solve our climate crisis. So, you know, let's try to figure it out, but we should not take it to the bank at all. You know, and there are a lot of folks who have studied this issue for a long time. As with hydrogen, you know, if we can figure out some carbon capture and storage and make it work at a reasonable cost, we're going to need that. We're going to need that for the sectors we can't decarbonize otherwise. So we don't want to start using it for all kinds of other applications where we can't rely on it, because what's that going to do is it's just going to delay a shift to decarbonization, and we're going to end up with this whole huge network of, you know, fracked gas pipelines and hydrogen production facilities, and then CO2 pipelines that take the carbon away and then put them in an underground pit, and all that stuff's going to leak and be expensive. And what a disaster that we have in the making right now, somewhat driven by the Biden administration, unfortunately.
I was going to get into that, actually. Yeah. That is, seems to be part of his Build Back Better plan of carbon storage and also hydrogen. So I wonder how that gets sorted out.
Yeah, so those two are really a pair, and they're going to travel around together in the conversation for the next many years, I imagine. It's going to be, you know, hydrogen, blue hydrogen, and CCUS, carbon capture, utilization, storage. We've got to talk about both of them at the same time. And they are in the Build Back Better, the infrastructure bill, that is. You know, probably a political necessity to get the bill passed was to include that stuff, but it's going to shovel, you know, billions of dollars of federal money, taxpayer money, into some big regional hydrogen hubs and carbon capture hubs across the country. And so lots and lots of risk there. And I don't think any of it is going to pencil out. I think it's all going to die under the weight of the bad economics, but you know, certainly lots of potential for waste in the meantime, and lots of potential for delay in the meantime.
You're listening to Locus Focus on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Oregon, Seattle stations KPFT, LPFM, and KODX, LPFM, KMUN and KCBB in Astoria, Oregon, KCEI in Taos, New Mexico, Radio Free Moscow in Idaho, and Radio Tacoma. And today we're talking with Eric DePlace, a fellow with the Ohio River Valley Institute, about the pros and cons of relying on hydrogen for our energy future. And I want to remind you that now is a good time to become a member of KBOO during the last week of our spring membership drive. KBOO receives 80% of our funding from our listeners, but only 10% of listeners are members. Help increase our listener-member ratio and meet our $56,000 goal by going to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Or you can mail a check to KBOO FM, 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, 97214. Your donation will be matched dollar for dollar up to $12,000 thanks to the generous support of a group of anonymous donors. Thanks for supporting community-powered radio. Well, let's talk more about carbon sequestration and why it's such a challenge.
It's an important thing to remember because it is not the case that if you have any project, whether it's a hydrogen project or some other project, because CCUS is attached to a lot of other ideas, that you necessarily get the benefits. Just because somebody says they're going to capture the hydrogen or the carbon dioxide and store it doesn't mean they actually can. And so what it entails, and I don't think this is being talked about near enough, is let's say you've got a manufacturing facility where you're taking fracked gas and you're converting it into hydrogen. So then you're going to grab all the carbon dioxide that's coming out of that process. And what are you going to do with it? So what they're going to do with it is they're going to put it in pipelines, CO2 pipelines. So they're going to have to build new pipelines all over the place to take that CO2 from that facility, from other facilities, and take it to some central location where it can be safely sequestered. And usually that's going to be underground, usually deep underground. And so then they're going to have to pipe that stuff into a storage facility underground. There is a whole suite of reasons to worry about the physical safety of building out a whole new network of CO2 pipelines, storing it underground, and not having that carbon dioxide either erupt and explode in some fashion, or to contaminate the nearby communities that can actually be, you know, high concentrations. It's actually quite dangerous. And then there's all the climate risks, which is like you're going to get leaks along that system. You might get leaks from the storage underground, and you might otherwise have problems where they're not able to capture the carbon at the point where the emissions are happening. And so between all those risks, what you have is a lot of very expensive infrastructure projects. Who's paying for that? You've got health and safety risks to a lot of communities. Who's concentrating on that right now? Nobody, really. And what are the long-term risks to climate protection? Probably pretty substantial, because if we end up burying this stuff and it stays there for 15 years, that's not good enough. That would be a disaster. And there's a real risk that we get an expensive, dangerous, and ineffective solution. That's what CCUS could be and is likely to be at large scale. So we need to make sure it's really figured out and we use it just in the cases where we really need to use it.
So how do we do that? Well, how do we figure that out?
Yeah. Well, I mean, again, it's going to take more research and development. And there is, I think, good, just like with vaccine development, we're going to have to spend R&D money on routes that may not pan out. So I'm all for the research and development part of it. But what we don't want to do is start deploying it or depending on it at a large capacity until that's more figured out. And the evidence that's coming back in now is pretty suggestive that we're not there yet and that we need to really understand this a lot better. And, you know, and again, we're probably going to need carbon capture and storage, you know, for niche applications, but we're not going to be able to do it most likely at large scales. We'll be able to do it at small scales. And so, you know, then it's figuring out how do you take the small scale ability to do this well, and where does that need to plug into the economy? Not how do we do this at a huge scale and keep business as usual, and we just keep driving gasoline-powered cars and heating our homes with fracked gas and you know, don't worry about it. We'll just store all the carbon under somebody's backyard. Like, that's not going to work. And that's kind of where the gas industry wants us to go, unfortunately.
Well, I wonder what we do about the politicians who are beholden to the gas industry, or in the case of Joe Manchin, actually make a very good living off of the coal industry. How do we deal with that kind of political pressure? Because it really feels like there's this new gravy train rolling down the tracks. Reminds me of the oil trains that were started rolling down 15 years ago. That is going to be really a challenge to stop. One of the things that I'm concerned about is the communities in the Northwest, like Tacoma and, of course, Centralia, which we talked about, which are hungry for some kind of energy development. And I understand that in Tacoma, there's a lot of talk about doing hydrogen development there as well.
The problem right now is that the federal government has set up this, what looks like a smorgasbord. It looks like a free buffet. And so you've got communities all over the country, in the Northwest, in Appalachia, in, you know, the Gulf, everywhere. All these communities are saying, oh gosh, we can rush into this buffet and we can get some free goodies from it. You know, my sense is that only a fraction of these projects ever pan out just for economic reasons. It's like the early days of the internet where you've got just a million and one bad ideas. A few good ideas are going to emerge out of it, probably, but you've got a bunch of small scale players and a bunch of big players, and everyone's just kind of throwing stuff out the wall right now. It's hard to speak specifically to like this Tacoma project, or, you know, I could give you a million examples from Pennsylvania. Most of them are not going to go anywhere. But what is the real worry, I think, is sort of to your question, which is that this becomes a big distraction. And what we do is, instead of decarbonizing as fast as possible, we say, oh, we've got these solutions. It's going to be hydrogen, CCUS, ammonia, whatever. And we don't keep our eye on the ball. The eye on the ball is, again, it's, you know, clean up the electricity system, electrify everything. Those two, over and over and over again. Just keep doing that. Keep doing that, and we're going to be, that's the best chance we have. The problem, as you point out, is that we do have a lot of leaders and elected officials who benefit from the fossil fuel industry, benefit from the gas industry. You know, part of the reason the infrastructure bill has in it what it has is because that's the politics. Like, it's hard to pass a big bill like that that doesn't stake in the existing players. And so, you know, that gets us into, I think, some really big conversations about, you know, money and politics and about our democratic system, which is obviously increasingly frail. And, you know, maybe more than I have the ability to understand or at least dissect on this show.
Yeah, it's a bit overwhelming. I'm just thinking about the elections that just happened here in Oregon 2 days ago, since we're talking. And there were some very promising results. There were some really good people who are looking like they may win in November. To me, the hope that there's some new blood in politics that might be able to see the difference between blue hydrogen and green hydrogen, for example, and green hydrogen and a truly renewable future. But I wonder how we support that strand as it comes head to head with the old guard.
I think it's going to be a big challenge. And I know that the listeners here are predominantly from the Northwest, but I'm of course from the Northwest too, and, you know, live here still. I'm much more worried about other places. I'm much more worried about, and I'm going to talk about the places I spend a lot of time now, Pennsylvania and West Virginia. In West Virginia, Congressman David McKinley, who's a Republican from West Virginia, has been in office for a long time, voted for the infrastructure bill and was taken out in the primary from the right by a Trump-backed candidate, Chris Mooney, who moved to the state. Is, you know, a radical right wing, not constructive, not helpful. You know, I could argue with McKinley all day long, but there's no question a better person to have in office in West Virginia than Mooney, in my opinion. And in Pennsylvania, the Republicans in the primary, they're going to put forward a guy who is, you know, he believes the big lie. He's been fomenting the big lie. There are big reasons to believe that if he were to win, Pennsylvania would not now actually send its electors for the duly elected president, you know, based on the results in that state. And so that's really scary. So I worry a lot more about places like Appalachia, and which have, frankly, a much bigger influence on American politics than Oregon and Washington do. I'm not feeling super optimistic at the moment, I guess, but, you know, we've got our work cut out for us, I guess we'll put it that way.
Well, I wanted to get back to green hydrogen and talk a little bit more about that, because you were saying that it has some applications, and I wanted to separate the wheat from the chaff there as opposed to what it can really do and what some of the hype about it is.
That's a great set of questions to ask, and probably the right way to think about it is almost like a ladder. And there are some applications where green hydrogen, you know, maybe the bottom rung, really makes sense. And then as you kind of go up the ladder, it may make less and less sense. And so we want to use it, you know, for the ones where it really definitely makes sense near the bottom, and not so much for the other ones. So, you know, the case that's used a lot would be for kind of applications, industrial applications, where you need a lot of high heat for something. And right now we might use coal or we might use gas. And so steel making is often used as an example of this. Being able to take away coal or gas in that application and use green hydrogen instead is almost certainly a good thing. Green steel manufacturing is being proposed in Sweden and other places, but how much of our total energy portfolio comes from steel making? Like, not that much. But there are some other, you know, kind of adjacent activities like that that are, again, high heat industrial applications. We don't yet have another good decarbonization strategy. We plug in hydrogen there. Wonderful. Then as you kind of go up the ladder, then you start getting to like, okay, then there's like aviation, or there's maritime applications, or there's long distance trucking. And maybe some of that stuff makes sense. Hydrogen's pretty energy dense, kind of like a fossil fuel is. Because of its energy density, it can be good for moving heavy objects long distances, but carefully. And then as you get into the rest of the transportation system, so light duty trucks, short distance trucks, passenger vehicles, no way, bad deal there, because we can electrify that stuff. Some people want to use hydrogen as a heating source in our homes or in businesses, maybe blended with existing natural gas streams, or maybe by itself. Terrible idea, because we can already electrify all that stuff. We already know how to clean up the electricity grid and electrify that stuff. So kind of as you move up the ladder, well, you don't want to move up the ladder. You want to keep hydrogen down just to that set of activities where we don't have some good alternative that we can turn to. Because most of the stuff we have now, we have other alternatives, and we should use those because they're better and cheaper.
Another concern I have about hydrogen is I understand it's pretty explosive. I have images of the Hindenburg as I think about hydrogen. And so I mean, right now I have natural gas flowing to our house, and it makes me very nervous having this pipeline that goes from the street into our house. Who knows what can happen? But I have a feeling that hydrogen is probably at least as explosive as methane. Am I correct?
It's dangerous, for sure. Yeah, I mean, it's. I don't know how to compare. I mean, methane is actually quite dangerous, too. It's also poisonous if you breathe it. So I'm not trying to get methane off the hook at all. But, you know, it is fair to say that hydrogen does not solve any of the safety problems, really. You know, and the other problem with hydrogen is that the molecules are much smaller than a methane molecule. And what that means is that there's much more opportunity to leak. And so all the pipes, the big transmission pipelines and the small little distribution pipelines that go to your house and unfortunately still to my house, those leak tiny quantities of methane right now, which is a potential health problem and a bit of a climate problem too. And so even if we fix that up, the hydrogen can still leak out of there. Or if we don't fix them up, even more hydrogen is leaking out, which means you're getting sort of less benefit from producing all that hydrogen in the first place. And then you can't really burn hydrogen very well in your furnace. It's not set up for that. It's set up for methane, not hydrogen. And so, you know, you end up with this kind of chain reaction of infrastructure problems and having to reinvest in upgrading the pipelines and the furnaces and everything else, you know, and it's going to cost a gajillion dollars. It might not work. Why not just do the simple and easy thing, which is, again, back to our two-step, electrify everything and clean up the electricity grid. We know how to do that stuff. The only thing standing in the way really is the gas industry at this point.
Well, I have heard lots of fantasies about hydrogen fuel cells and that in the future our cars would have hydrogen fuel cells as opposed to electric vehicles. And I guess supposedly they would not have the same problems of range that electric vehicles have because they're not dealing on a storage battery. I'm not exactly sure how a fuel cell works, but I guess you can just fill your car with hydrogen. Is that the theory?
Yeah, more or less, yeah.
What would be the advantages and disadvantages of driving cars that were hydrogen fuel cells?
Yeah, so if you've been around the environmental movement for a while, you know that back in the day there was all this talk about a hydrogen highway and California was going to invest in it. That didn't pan out for a bunch of reasons. One, it's quite expensive. Two, electricity is just easier to work with for cars. It's cleaner, you know, the whole nine yards. Now, the hydrogen fuel cell thing hasn't completely gone away. And to use the latter analogy, it's the second or third rung up there, is we might want to think about hydrogen fuel cells for long distance, heavy haul trucking. So because you've got a lot of energy density in there and you need to move something that's heavy for a long ways, hard to electrify that one, maybe not impossible, but difficult. And so that's a place where, you know, green hydrogen might play a role. I think it's a question mark. We'll see how it pans out. But, you know, we don't want blue hydrogen because that's got a whole nest of problems. If we could figure out something better, probably shouldn't even use green hydrogen, but maybe that's an application for it. And so if you add up all that stuff and you add up the steel making and some other industrial applications, maybe that's 10-15% of our total current carbon emissions. So it's not nothing, but you know, we don't want it in the majority of our transportation at all. We don't want it in home heating or any of that stuff. It's a good question, but it's, you know, I think it's a question mark.
Well, you're listening to Locus Focus on KBOO Radio in Portland, Oregon, Seattle stations KBFT LPFM and KODX LPFM, KMUN and KCBB in Astoria, Oregon, KCEI in Taos, New Mexico, Radio Free Moscow in Idaho, and Radio Tacoma. And today we're talking with Eric DePlace, a fellow with the Ohio River Valley Institute, about the pros and cons of relying on hydrogen for our energy future. And I want to remind you that now is a good time to become a member of KBOO during the last week of our spring membership drive. KBOO has trained thousands of people how to make radio all for free thanks to the support we receive from our members. Please support this vital community institution and meet our $56,000 goal by going to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Or you can mail a check to KBOO FM, 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, 97214. Your donation will be matched dollar for dollar up to $12,000 thanks to the generous support of a group of anonymous donors. Thanks for supporting community-powered radio. One of the things that I am puzzled by is that it seems like this part of the environmental movement are people who ally themselves with environmentalists who are big touters of hydrogen and are projecting having these hydrogen hubs. Like there's a company that a friend of mine has a friend who is working for that is basically talking about creating hydrogen centers all around the Northwest, all the way to Idaho and maybe to Salt Lake City, and creating a hydrogen infrastructure. And I looked at their website and it looks very positive in terms of how feasible it is. They also make references to how this is already being done in Europe. So a couple questions. First of all, how far along is Europe with developing hydrogen? And how feasible would it be for these hydrogen networks to be created here?
This is an area where there's a lot more sizzle than there is steak. Europe is not that far along in it. There, you know, like I said, Sweden is doing some stuff with green steel manufacturing. There are some little things here and there, but are they farther along than the United States? Not really. As in the United States, the majority of hydrogen in Europe is gray hydrogen. It's polluting. Europe's also trying to decarbonize. There's a lot of marketing hype around this stuff. And I think, you know, without referring specifically to the proposal you're talking about, which I'm not familiar with, it doesn't sound realistic. It doesn't sound like a good idea to me. Your question is good. I mean, it's in the sense that there's an observation, an unfortunate observation, that there are a lot of folks who, in the environmental community, who I think really, frankly, get distracted by the next shiny object. And, you know, if we rewind, you know, 10 or 15 years ago, there's this big fracking boom happening, and it's, you know, according to some people, it's going to be a good deal because it's going to get us off coal, and it's the bridge fuel to a clean energy future. And, you know, that largely is not true. And as a consequence, it was a big distraction. It slowed down decarbonization by a lot. It was a huge mistake. Now we're getting the same round of talk about hydrogen and about carbon capture. And the right solution here is the simple and the cheap solution. Like, just stop using fossil fuels. And again, it's back to the two-step. Clean up the electricity grid and electrify everything. And that's the way forward. Instead of, okay, here's a new fancy technology. Here's a new thing we can dangle in front of you. But we can still keep using gas, or we can still keep using fossil fuels. We got to stop. We have to stop, because we're out of time. We ran out of time a while ago. And I really wish that my friends and allies in the environmental movement could be clear about this and stop getting distracted by shiny new developments that are supposed to make everything better, which, by the way, aren't proven. We know are very expensive and have the really nasty side effect of prolonging the fossil fuel industry, an industry that is inimical to the climate and inimical to our democracy and a bunch of other stuff too. You'll get me ranting in a second, so I'm going to stop. But, you know, your question is right on point.
I was reading an article the other day about something that our mayor here in Portland said in response to decarbonizing the transportation system in Portland. And it was also kind of a veiled dig at the person who's the city commissioner who is in charge of the Department of Transportation in Portland, because he was saying that we can't really, it's unfair to people to make them get out of their cars. We need to get people back into downtown Portland, and we can't make them have to pay extra money to come into downtown Portland or make it harder for them to park. And the article was very critical of the mayor, and it made me concerned that this mayor, who I think likes to see himself as a climate champion, as do many of these people, basically doesn't want to get out of his car. I mean, I don't want to get out of my car either, you know, but it's like something you look at least every time I drive now, I'm really guilty.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I'm as guilty as the next person. I'm not going to try to hold myself up as someone who's, you know, magically transcended our carbon-based economy. We all live and breathe this stuff. And even if you don't drive a gasoline-powered car, you get stuff delivered, or you buy stuff that's been delivered to a grocery store or whatever. We're all trapped in the system. We have to do different things to get out of the jam we're in. And you know, having, you know, dense downtowns and appropriate levels of residential density in cities is a good thing. It reduces our need to drive. Maybe you still have a car, but you don't drive it as many miles. Parking takes up a huge amount of space in urban environments that is not a good use of space, really. We don't need more space to store cars than we do to store people or for people to live. You know, Portland's lucky that Portland made good intentional choices to have a walkable downtown with some transit, a bunch of transit options. And it can be a pleasant place to be. And so, you know, take advantage of those assets that were not, you know, Portland, those didn't just happen by accident. Like, Portland created and built those things and made an environment, you know, where it can be easy to either leave behind your car entirely or to use it very little. Keep moving in that direction. That's great for decarbonization. You know, so that's all I'd say to that, I guess.
I find it kind of discouraging, again, because it feels like one of these false equivalencies, but that the mayor thinking that the only way we're going to get people back into using downtown, because it's still, I think a lot of businesses are still hybrid. I mean, I know that when I'm downtown, I don't see as many people on the streets as I did before the pandemic. But to think that you have to entice them back into downtown by having them drive, I mean, right now parking is much easier downtown. So that was one of the things that actually got me to not drive downtown for a long time. I do think, I mean, I sort of see that we need to have these kind of negative incentives in some ways to make to change behavior. Like when you can't find parking, like in Seattle, when I go to visit you, especially when you were at Sightline, it was not much fun looking for parking. And it was also very expensive. And that's a good incentive not to drive. I don't know how we find more positive incentives. And that was one of the criticisms, actually, that the mayor made, was that the Department of Transportation in Portland hasn't done a good enough job of providing real good alternatives to cars. In fact, I think that can be debated, that Portland Transportation has made a lot of changes. I still think the bus system isn't as good as it should be to really do away with cars in parts of town. It was ironic to me is the one place it's really easy to get to by bus in Portland is downtown. It's more difficult if you're trying to get from one end of the city to the other. So let's talk a little bit about positive and negative incentives and how we might be able to change behavior that way.
It's a good observation, and I think the context is no downtown in America right now is really at the top of its game. I mean, everything changed with COVID and the move to remote work, and so there probably is going to have to be some reconfiguration of downtowns. You know, if you go to downtown Seattle, I'm near downtown Seattle right now, the parking is much cheaper and more available than the last time you drove down there. I can assure you of that. And it's a real shame because we had here in Seattle a really kind of high density of businesses and residents flourishing downtown. It had some issues, of course, but it was, you know, there were a lot of people there, and it doesn't feel that way now. You know, so if you want to drive your car to downtown Seattle right now, it's easy. And that is not a sign of health. The sign of health actually is the experience that you had, unfortunately, which is that it's kind of expensive and a pain to drive and park downtown. And hopefully what there are a set of other options. There's, you know, we've got a light rail line that goes down, and we'll have another one soon. You know, we've got a pretty decent bus system, actually. And hopefully a network of walkable streets that allows people to get there the old fashioned way. And, you know, so I don't like to think about them as sort of negative incentives so much as we should create an environment that's built around, you know, letting people flourish. So let's have killer sidewalks and let's have killer bike lanes and great bus routes. And that stuff that people who can't drive or don't have a car, can't afford a car, can all make use of that stuff. You know, rail lines when that makes sense, streetcar lines when that makes sense. You know, and when we see all that stuff in place, then you see a lot of people using that kind of space. And sure, if you're coming from out of town and you want to drive downtown and park downtown, that might be kind of slow and expensive. But okay, like that's a small price to pay for a healthy, flourishing downtown that supports businesses and arts and sports and, you know, and people living there and old people and young people and all the rest of it. You know, I think it's kind of silly to think that we can have flourishing downtowns and have everyone driving around in their own personal car by themselves. Like the geometry just doesn't make sense. Like you can't physically do it. You could do it at a shopping mall where you have acres of asphalt. That's not very pleasant though.
Well, sort of to sum up, it sounds like that if we plan our cities better, if we develop ways to get around without cars, and we I think we need to have some kind of government payouts for people to change their heating and their cooking so that they're not using gas anymore. And hopefully we'll see some kinds of reimbursements for that at some point, that maybe we don't need hydrogen.
I think that's right. I think there are lots and lots of ways to decarbonize that make a ton of sense that don't involve hydrogen. I'm doing this interview with you from a little cubicle because at my house is loud right now because they're putting solar panels on the roof. And I'm not doing that primarily because for environmental reasons, although that's a nice benefit. I'm doing it because it actually makes economic sense. There are enough incentives in place and the cost is down now to a place where it'll be cheaper for me to pay the financing for these solar panels than to pay my power bill. When that's happening in a cloudy place like Seattle, that's when we unleash the clean energy economy. It's happening right now. We're on the right track. We need to go faster. And so let's keep doing that and not chase shiny objects that the gas industry is dangling in front of us, like hydrogen. It's going to take us absolutely the wrong direction.
Well, Eric, it's always great to talk to you. And I'm glad we ended on that upbeat note. Good luck with your solo panels. I hope you enjoy them and have a long life with them.
Thank you.
And hopefully we'll talk again soon.
Thank you, Barbara. It's been a pleasure to be on your show. Good luck.
We've been talking with Eric DePlace, fellow with the Ohio River Valley Institute, and you've been listening to Locus Focus on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Oregon, Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM, KMUN and KCBB in Astoria, Oregon, KCEI in Taos, New Mexico, Radio Free Moscow in Idaho, and Radio Tacoma. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed, or you want your friends or family to hear the show, you can listen to a podcast on our website, kboo.fm/locus-focus. To hear previous episodes of the show or any of our KBOO Public Affairs programming, go to kboo.fm or listen on iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts. I want to give special thanks to the KBOO staff who are doing an incredible job of not only keeping KBOO on the air, but helping all us volunteers make the best radio possible from home during this pandemic. And you can help us reach our $56,000 goal during the last week of our spring membership drive by becoming a member of KBOO or renewing your membership if you're already a member. We're independent, community-supported, volunteer-powered radio. Go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Or please support the community station you're listening to right now. Thanks for supporting community-powered radio. I also want to mention that last week's guest, Liz Carlisle, will be at Pal City of Books on Burnside on May 24th at 7 p.m. to read from her new book, Healing Ground. I'm Barbara Bernstein. Next week, we'll talk with Catherine Chuddy about why nuclear power is still not a good idea. We'll go out with music by Kate and Anna McGarrigle. Thanks for listening. Stay safe, wash your hands, get your COVID shots, and remember to socially distance when necessary and wear a mask.
Just a little atom of chlorine, valence minus one. Swimming through the sea, digging the scene, just having fun. She's not worried about the shape or size of her outside shell. It's fun to ionize just a little atom of Cl with an unfilled shell. But somewhere in that sea lurks handsome sodium. With enough electrons on his outside shell, plus that extra one. Somewhere in this deep blue sea, there's a negative for my extra energy. Yes, somewhere in this foam, my positive will find a home. Then unsuspecting chlorine felt a magnetic pull. She looked down and her outside shell was full. Sodium cried, what a gas, be my bride. And I'll change your name from chlorine to chloride. Now the sea evaporates to make the clouds fall. Chemical compounds in the absence of H2O. But the crystals have washed away.